So one of the things about doing this kind of assignment is that you get asked to come up with a title 6 months before you're supposed to show up. And when I got asked to speak here this time, I'm not sure what prompted the choice of this title. I was in a circumstance where I think I was likely reading one of the books for the next class I was teaching in the Doctor of Ministry program. And I think the book, since one of my students is sitting there, he had a sitting in class with me, I think the book was Christian Imagination. The Christian Imagination, the subtitle is Theology and the Origins of Grace, written by Willie Jennings in 2010. I'm still wrestling with the ramifications of what Jennings does in that book. Because he starts with the impact of colonialism on evangelism. He starts with European conquering of the rest of the planet. And the impact that has on Christianity, and the impact Christianity in that colonialist form then has on the rest of the world. And I was just struck in this ongoing sort of culmination of my own life with this overwhelming sense of the brokenness of American Christianity given that story. The brokenness of our capacities to even read texts given that story. The brokenness of imagining translation inside of that story, of forming languages and words for African peoples out of that colonialist beginning, or in South America, same kind of thing. And I have no answers for that. I just felt the weight of it. And at 65 years old, I also felt the weight then of somebody saying, white men have been privileged in this culture in ways that women and people of color have not. And you can't just keep ignoring it. And in Churches of Christ in particular, as a white male, I've had access to a career in the academy that my sisters did not have, and that my African-American brothers did not have. Now, they may say, right, we're trying to open up those horizons today, but in my world, growing up in the 60s and being educated in the 70s and the 80s, no. I have to wrestle with the fact that I am in a Church of Christ school, and I've always been in a Church of Christ school because it was safer to find a job for a white male Church of Christ guy whose dad was a Church of Christ preacher in a Church of Christ school than it was to go venturing off someplace else and have to compete with everyone else. So all those are pieces of the story. So a few disclaimers about the title. If I were retitling this book, I would stick the stamp from the beginning, something that I stole from another outstanding book Ibram Kendi. Many of you know this book, right? And it's a quote that he actually takes from Jefferson Davis, from a congressional speech, I think, in about 1859 or 1860, before the secession of the South. And it's a comment made about the quality of African lives as inferior to Eurocentric lives. And I still like that title because there's a piece of this whole thing that we need to stand from the beginning as a Church of Christ preacher's son. The last parts of it, there are lots of problems with the last parts of it. Telling my own truths. Truth is way too strong a term. Telling my own beliefs. Truth has become a really problematic word for me over the course of the last 25 years of my life. It's not that I don't believe in truth. It is like that I'm very suspicious of the things I call truth. Because the truth of it is they move too many times. The stuff that I do is absolutely true, and you need to know I'm an Enneagram 1, which means I have to be right. And if it's not right, I have to get it fixed. Or as my friend told me, who gave me Myers Briggs years ago, John, you have the General Patton Syndrome. Always know you're right, especially when you're wrong. So being right is so deeply embedded in me. The coming to grips with being right, not being a salvific approach to life, has been very difficult. Telling the truth, knowing what the truth is, it's not that I think truth has become relative, it is that I think I've become relative. At a variety of levels, truth has become this moving target that I'm always on a quest for. And never certain of arrival. Well, that's not true. Always certain of arrival. Only to discover I was not there yet. So those pieces are a part of all of this. I've been deeply shaped over the last few years by that travel course. I now refer to it as my own trip of unknowing. And sort of tell you a little bit about the trip. We take our students first just in Nashville to this university, a historic African-American school. We've had other circumstances at various times in town for them to go and see other things that happen to be in town at the time. We start at this and talk about the evening singers, and we listen to freedom songs sung by an African-American group, and we begin to deal with the history of race and racism in Nashville. Now we have to go to the Woolworth store that's been redone, where the original counter sit-ins took place. And then we get everyone up the next morning, and we go on a bus ride. And we start at the 16th Street Church in Birmingham, where the four girls were killed in a bombing in 1963. So we get there and we go on this tour. And mind you, most of the students that are on the trip are not old enough to have been alive in 1963 to remember it one way or another. But I'm painfully aware that I was alive. And I realized as we were doing the tour, and they were naming these girls' names and talking about the youngest one who was 11, that in 1963, in September, I would have been dead. And I can tell you about November 1963, but I have absolutely no memory of September 1963. And I was struck by that. Not just that she was a girl nearly my age, but that I could grow up and have no memory of her. We went from there to Selma, to Brown's Chapel, where Joyce O'Neill changed my life. Because in 1965, another year that I remember, but I don't remember anything about Bloody Sunday, I know it from history. I know it from newsreel, but I don't remember seeing it in 1965. Joyce was our docent at Brown's Chapel. She talked about being 14 that year, going to the various meetings in the different churches around town over the course of that year. Of her sister, who was 2 years younger than her, being arrested in some of the teen protests that went on there. And on the one hand, it was a badge of courage for the teens who were arrested. On the other hand, she said her sister had really never gotten over all of that. Her sister refuses to be a docent at Brown's Chapel. And she told about without being at Brown Chapel on Sunday, that Sunday, when they left the church and headed to the bridge. Their parents wouldn't let her and her sister go, so they stayed at church. And she began to recall the stories of hearing the gunshots, and then the screams, and then the horses, and seeing the people running back trying to rip their clothes off because the tear gas was on them, and they were trying to escape the tear gas. And the teenagers and the others in the church running out with anything they could to cover these people up who were trying to rip their clothes off, and getting the tear gas on them, and the screams, and all of the hollering, and the agony. She was 14 in 1965, I was 12. One of our students, David Clear, leads the class, and he has a great habit of having students read different excerpts from different speeches. And so, in Brown's Chapel, he asked permission if one of our students could read Malcolm X's speech, The Field Slave and the House Slave. So Josh Love read the speech. When he finished, I looked over at Joyce and I said, "Read here to that." And she looked across the room and she said, "I was sitting right there." My God, I hadn't thought that in such a long time. And you did it so well. Could I just give you all of that? And as we drove away in our bus, the children in this not-so-good part of town, we would call it not-so-good because even today it's still a place where the housing is limited. It's predominantly African-American. And the students used their hands to say what they thought of our big white bus with all of our white people in it driving on. And I realized, yet again, that I was offended, and I understood that. Because there was a sense in which I was using them, again, for my vicarious experience. And using their talent, again, for my vicarious experience. Well, I could go on and on with the story. I was blessed when the National Museum of African American History and Culture was opened in Washington, D.C. A group of us happened to be in Washington a month later. We got to go to that. If you've not been, I highly encourage you to go because you can't walk through it without being overwhelmed by these experiences of actually having to deal with the slave experience of how people were ripped from their space and their place and brought and made to be property in all kinds of harmful and hateful and permanent damaged ways. And there's a recurring phrase that occurs as you're walking and reading. And this is a paraphrase, but it has to do with the idea of whiteness. So as they're naming all of these laws, they talk about the way in which the idea of whiteness was created. Because until the laws were created that made sure that color of people knew what kind of not person they were, until you had those kinds of laws, you really didn't have a sense of what it was to be white instead of some other color. Ta-Nehisi Coates likes to talk about the people who think they're white in his book, Between the World and Me. But this whole idea of creating laws so that this group of people understands that, and the laws were very specific. Kennedy's book does a great job of this, where he talks about the way in which these laws were formed so that the indentured servants that were Eurocentric in background had freedom on the horizon. The indigenous people could be freed some saved, maybe. But the people of color, the Africans, were slaves in perpetuity. And they created laws to sustain this. And in Kennedy's book, it gets very personal early on. I'm not saying that my notes very well, but this close. In Kennedy's book, he's got a whole chapter called Saving Souls, Not Bodies. And as a person who grew up, and mind you, I've never liked the phrase saving souls. I always wondered why we save souls when we talk about evangelism. Because it always seemed to me a soul ought to be attached to something. But what Kennedy does is take us back to the era of Cotton Mather and the laws in Virginia and other places that were being put on the books to create this perpetuity system for blacks and all progeny of the blacks that were your slaves and the ownership rights and the selling and the trading and all those kinds of things that go on. And the question was, can these slaves be evangelized? And there were two different major thoughts going on at the time. One was that you had a kind of multi-genesis world in which they really weren't human beings like white people or human beings in the first place. You had all kinds of classifications that were to create a species that wasn't fully human, and they were from Africa. And there were hierarchies of humans, right? So the Eurocentric folks, those were at the top of the list, and then you begin to work down, and then somewhere along the way you come to the Jews, and then somewhere down at the bottom you get to the Africans, and you got the Asians in there someplace. The Eurocentric is always at the top. White, as we came to know ourselves, is always at the top. And the question is, what do you do with it? And some thought that if you evangelize them, they will be more docile. There's a reason to do this, because if they know Jesus, they will be kinder, gentler, softer property. They'll be more manageable. I didn't know that Sambo was a character in that story. I just thought Sambo was the restaurant in Roseburg where I grew up. Mather finally came up with a solution. And they had a problem because in Virginia, if you were a Christian, you could not be enslaved. So you got two things at work, right? Should we Christianize them? Should we not Christianize them? If we do, and they're Christian, does that mean we now have to free them? And they finally decided that because it's their bodies that are the property, we don't have to free them, and it's only their souls that we're trying to save. And their souls, you'll like this, their souls are white. It's just their bodies that are black. So we say souls, not bodies. And I don't know, I mean, yes, I understand the translations of Acts and how many souls are saved on Pentecost. But that language comes to permeate all of evangelical Christianity in my lifetime. And unfortunately, too many times has seemed to me, even though the color of skin has changed, we've still been much more in the faceless business than we have been in the face business. And salvation has been far more about souls than it has been about bodies and being human and fully human and all those kinds of things. Well, let me back up and go to Roseburg, Oregon, where I was raised. I was born there. I was born in Bedford. My grandfather, on my dad's side, my grandparents moved there somewhere around 1946, if I know the story correctly. And please know that there is no discouraging of my parents or my ancestry in any of this, any more than I am discouraging any of you. I'm trying to talk about a story that is shaped on the one hand by systemic circumstances and cultural circumstances in which any of us as individuals can say this or that about ourselves. and our own character. Apart from that. Right? Racism is a systemic issue, not a personal one for many people. And many people like me have used all the excuses for lots of years about how we're not participants in this. Right? Whether it's naming our black friends, or naming how we've always been open in our workplace, or whatever it is that we can name. For me, it's been coming to grips with the fact that none of those excuses get at the heart of the problem, which is the specific privileges that have come to me because of the color of skin and the gender of my body. But that's a different thing altogether. Roseburg, Oregon. As late as I saw a thing, well, you know, what can we trust on the line, right? But a census from, I think it's 2000, maybe it's just 1990 in Roseburg, that showed how many people of color live there now. This is not 1953 when I grew up, but in the 50s there were zero people of color. In the 60s, I'm not sure the count's right because I know there were four. Everybody in town knew there were four, but they were only there for 3 years because he was adopted to VA hospital with his two kids and his wife. So I grew up with no experiences at all. I had minimal exposure otherwise. So on the one hand, not knowing that the news stories about 1963 or 1965, we didn't travel in 1965. We got in a 9-passenger station wagon, my uncle's family and our family, 5 of them, 4 of us, and traveled all the way to New York City, by the way, in Niagara Falls, and then down to Paducah, Kentucky, strangely enough, and Murray, Kentucky. I remember that. And I remember the fear factors all along the way when we would get outside the lines of where we knew it was safe to be. What I knew about African Americans in 1965 was shaped by some of the civil rights circumstances. I knew about all the problems Pepperdine College had because of the Watts riots in 1965. And I knew about everything that our family said about those experiences in 1965. I knew about Martin Luther King in 1965, and I knew about what everybody in church said about Martin Luther King at that time in my experience. So this is Roseburg, Oregon. Up only recently did I learn Oregon's own history with regard to race. And some of you may not know this. Oregon is the only state in which, when it became a state, its constitution had a clause in it prohibiting immigrants of African American descent from coming into the state. Even though the 13th and 14th Amendments were passed, they did not remove that clause from the constitution until 1926. One person has gone through and tried to find all the Sundowner towns in Oregon. Towns that had implicit or explicit laws that said if you are of the wrong color of skin, you better be out of town before sundown or else. Roseburg was one of those towns, no probability. Medford, they're more sure about because, according to some reports, there was a sign at the armory in Medford into the 1960s warning people of color to get out of town before sundown. I don't know when my grandparents moved from, well, the story of our family is they moved from Michigan, Flint, Michigan, to Medford, Oregon, because of my grandmother's health. And the rest of the accident, right? That we also removed ourselves from anything having to do with people of color. So I was raised in that environment, in a Church of Christ environment, which in the 1950s is kind of the height of its sectarian glory. We are saving a lot of souls from the wrongness of their other church traditions. Right, we can go back and read all the stat sheets that Macklin and others would have been developing at the time. That's when we were really rolling. The evangelism, and, you know, that's when you could go hear one of our great preachers somewhere talking about what's wrong with the Methodist or the Baptist or the Catholics or the Presbyterians or whatever. That was kind of the height of our being right. And when I do my core values to this day, you know, the things you learned at the time you were 11 years old in order to survive, I learned to survive by being right. The highest value in my life is being right. And that's continued to wear upon me. I guess that's why I have to make this kind of confessional speech, right? I've got to get right again. But my experience with that whole story, I mean, Martin Luther King was a philandering communist. That's how all of that was managed. And I was completely removed from it for all of those years. Completely removed from the basis. And so on the one hand, it's like all forms of prejudice, right? The form of prejudice are mostly around what you don't know. It's out of the fears based on all that you don't know that leads you to have all of these kinds of things that come over you when you're in the presence of other people that are not like you. And that, you know, that went into my college days, and there are pieces of my college days that I never thought twice about. I never thought twice about the fact that when I got to Abilene Christian in 1974, I had to have a job, so I ended up in the cafeteria. And there was a young female student, African-American female student, who also went to work the same day I did. And we both went to work in the dishwashing room at the same time. She happened to be the girlfriend of Wilbur Montgomery. And if you recognize that name, he's the above all other football players that ever went through ACU and went on to great fame, with the Philadelphia Eagles, yeah. Right? Wilbur was a star. This was his girlfriend. It never dawned on me to ask why, after 2 weeks, I got promoted out of the dishwashing room, and she never did. Never asked that question. Why I ended up being the cook's buddy. She kept washing dishes. I started working in Grand Texas. In Grand Texas had a bus ministry. And our bus would go to that part of town where the black families all lived, and we would pick up the black children. And we would faithfully and joyfully bring them to Bible class every Sunday until they were 11 years old. And then we stopped picking them up. Our program just went 10 years old. And I remember everything else that was said about those older black people in that town. But it didn't bother me enough to say anything about it. I just noticed it. I was blessed to go to Emory University for graduate school and had great experiences at Emory. Some of the best at the hands of an atheist professor who treated me more Christianly than so many of the people I had at Abilene and other places along the way. And I had to make sense of that, which was not easy. But I worked at the Hillcrest Church. And over the years, patted myself on the back because I was a Hillcrest Church. Hillcrest Church was 60% white and 40% black. Hillcrest had moved from Kirkwood, downtown Atlanta, when the neighborhood transitioned. Our good word for what happens when people of color start moving into traditionally white spaces. So they moved to the suburb of Decatur, only to discover that Gator was transitioning as well. And the next time they didn't move. They stayed. They said, we'll serve us ministry, and we'll bring these kids in, and we'll reach their parents. And they did. And by the time I arrived there to be their pretend youth ministry, because I never was very good at it, because I just never was very good at it. But people liked my kids a lot. And they became grandparents to my kids. Whether they were black or white, that became grandparents to my kids. In my experience in particular, two of the young men in the youth group, both really brilliant African-American kids who got bussed way across town to go to some other school besides the neighborhood school. It was very common. I remember a drive we made one day. We were buildings in part, right? And so you're always trying to find what it looks like for you wherever you live. So we decided to drive north to try to find the streams where we heard people fish for trout, and it was mountainous and all those kinds of things. And on the drive, we ended up going through Cumming, Georgia. Now, we went through a lot of other places as well. But Cumming was one of these interesting things that day because it was a Saturday, and as we got to town, it looked like we were driving into a movie set. And I couldn't quite figure it out. And it wasn't until we'd driven out on the other side that I did figure it out, where all these people have these white robes on and these pointed masks, and hats on their heads. And we had driven into the middle of a KKK rally. And didn't know it. And kind of brushed it off. And put it in our bank of memories from Georgia. Along with all of the other places that one could drive in Georgia at the time, where the disparity economically was just overwhelming. But good experiences in no press. Years later, before I realized that we had this great camaraderie because these people had been converted out of their other experiences into this white Church of Christ, which is the only Church of Christ they knew. I noticed at the time that when we had African Americans from black Churches of Christ come and try to figure out the space, they never lasted. Because it was a white church with black people in it. And it's been years later that I realized that's about the only way we know how to do integrated churches. Black churches invite white people to come have black church experiences, and white churches invite black people to come have white church experiences. We don't know how to do something where there is a shared story and a shared experience and shared culture. A student led me a book called Joyous People this semester by William Barberholt and African American, which the subtitle has to do with contemplative practices of the black church. Well, the earth contemplative practices don't look like all the white solitude of Europe. They look like the drums and dances of Africa. I haven't had space for that. Don't know what to do with it. Have moved around since then, right? We ended up going into full-time preaching with back in Texas for a while, in Temple, Texas, where I knew the stories of the black church that the white church had helped build. Alan's back there. Alan knows those stories too, right? Out of our great benevolence, not to mention the fact that we didn't really want them worshiping with us. We built them a building and gave them support. Lived with all of those kinds of things with some distance and participated fully in all of the lives any person like me would have used and still can use, which I celebrate the fact that I'm not racist. I have black friends. I worked at a multicultural church. Right? I follow the lines. And I it all worked until Kid Green came to town in 2001. His three lectures are now recorded in a book at Gary Holloway, and I edited most of Gary edited. But I was the director of the program, so he had to do something with me. The book is called Unfinished Reconciliation at ACU Press, published a few years ago, and then redid a few years after that. But it was Ken who first split my head open with institutional racism. With the whole notion that there's a whole economic system that our nation itself in so many ways is founded on the backs of this economic system, in which people of color and people of Asian descent both become the working force to sustain the habits of the white powerful that are in charge of the system. And yes, women, I know that I'm talking mostly about the men, although tomorrow I will talk mostly about the male part of this privilege. But when you start thinking about it systemically, when you start thinking about the ways in which, there are a number of great books to read right now. If you've not read on this, one is by a guy named David DeLong called Race and Place, in which he takes the redlining maps from the 30s and 40s and shows where both the government and real estate work hand in hand, the lending agencies work hand in hand to create these parts of the city that were designated as black or people of color zones, and you had people of color couldn't get loans to get anything else other than that housing. And people that were white were always dissuaded from moving to those parts of town. They only went to the other parts of town. All the government projects, this is in the color of law, all the government project housing that was built in the 20s and 30s and early 40s, all of that has lines of segregation always marked out, the white communities, the black communities. What was created for lower middle class ends up being for lower class and always segregated. The law takes those redlining maps and it overlays current demographics and where the poorer housing areas and the poorer people live today, and you'll not be surprised to know that they still match up in every major urban city in America. You want to know how systemic racism works? What happens when you leave a whole group of people two and three and four generations behind in landholding and the potential then to begin as a family to create wealth in a system that otherwise demands, by all measures of success, the accumulation of wealth. Now, we could try to throw Jesus in here at any moment, Ben Wayne, and can talk about what our value systems are with regard to individuals, with regard to economic systems. So you start thinking back, I start then thinking back about my life, about the things that I just assumed were normal. You just think you're growing up normal without thinking about the definition of normal being white. Not anything else. You create all the rationales. Most of the rationales have to do with people who work harder and smarter than people who don't work harder and smarter. Right? So even though I can take all the stories of poverty out of my family game, I can then start telling you all the smarter and harder stories out of my family game. And that justifies without ever questioning. What was it that my white preacher dad, I would guarantee you that if a black preacher had been in Roseburg And he had gone to the local bank, what my dad did every Friday, and asked for $30 so that he could buy food for lunch for the people that would be his house guests on Sunday, which he always got, and then always paid back on Monday, but he got paid on Sunday. But a block had gotten the same from that bank. I mean, you just start working through how many layers of this there are. And so coming to grips with that, not trying to get to solutions, but just beginning to have my eyes, my glasses on, to see all the ways in which that privilege comes to me. There's a great book that came out last year by Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility. I recommend it to you. That's a great place. She will do a much better job than I can do of distinguishing between racism and prejudice and discrimination and privilege. Right? They're all different words. She argues that racism is something that only those with power can be. Only people with power can be truly racist. People of color, she argues, can't be racist because they never had power. They can be prejudiced. They can be discriminating. But only the people who are prejudiced and discriminating with power can be racist. She makes a big deal about distinguishing white supremacy and racism as systemic issues rather than being always about the terrorists. The other way we dismiss white supremacy is to put them in an idol and make them crazy. Right? They're the terrorist brand of white supremacists. We make the racists only KKK and worse. And it's a way of protecting ourselves, of hedging ourselves off from the way in which systemically otherwise we are both benefiting from and contributing to. And that's one of the things that I've really been struggling with. Right? How in the name of Jesus? How in the name of the ethics of Jesus? Am I doing the opposite of Jesus? I told somebody earlier, Richard, I'm sure you and many others have thought of this, right? By the way, Richard has rewritten his book, Myths of American Lives, by with a new chapter on the myth of white supremacy, which I highly recommend to you. The subtitle now, Richard, is White Supremacy
and the Stories That Give Us Meaning.
And the Stories That Give Us Meaning. Really, really powerful material. Very powerful material. I highly recommend that to you. It's at least ironic, isn't it, that the Watts riots led Noel Young to dream of a different location for the school, and Noel is credited with keeping the fires off of the campus in 1965, in the media reports at least. And they moved to this campus, where on how many occasions the campus has almost burned to the ground? Can't make that up. Right? They left to escape that and those. Because this almost happened. Only to come out here, where on the one hand they are completely removed from those parts of town. Fires are still with us. So I stand before you today person who's struggling. Not just to name how being the color skin that I am with my Eurocentric skin has shaped at the most fundamental levels my very understanding of Christianity. Jesus is always Eurocentric. And if you watch the movies, he speaks British English. And we are affronted by people talking about the black Jesus. Have you ever wondered why? Why that is? Why would that be an affront? Because we made it in our image, didn't we? Struggling to figure out how, if I believe as I do, that at the heart of what it means to be in Christ is that reconciling relationships is the most important thing and most important gift of God on this planet. If that's what I believe to be true, which I do, I believe Jesus became flesh and dwelt among us to demonstrate what it means to be human in the image of God for the sake of the rest of creation. And when we follow him around, every face gets seen, every relationship gets valued, every healing is about salvation, because they're always about making a person fully human. And part of all gospel is the healing of all relationships. And the job of new creation people is the reconciliation of all things. If I believe that, which I do, then there has to be something at the heart of anything I would call evangelism that has to do with loving rather than being right, that has to do with seeing every face, not having privilege exclusions, and with ultimately telling the truth about how much of my life isn't just gift of God, the gift of a cultural circumstance that was extremely privileged simply because the color of my skin in this culture and the gender of my body. Now, like I said, I'll come back tomorrow and talk about the male-female. The male-female piece is a bit different, isn't it? Because, well, We long ago figured out what to do with the slavery text, but we're still trying to figure out what to do with the male-female text. And as I said to somebody else today, how we read scripture is always at the heart of all of these conversations. So I want to come back and talk about my male privilege tomorrow. Thanks for being here today. See you next time.